Blog Talk Radio.
Sunday afternoon, it's Shelly Nunchucks on the Shelly Nunchucks Show, bringing you great guests and positivity. Well, wherever you may be, it could be morning, noon, and night, and happy, 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 it's Sunday. Yes, and I'm even going for a little celebration after my show. And I got to tell you, this whole site, last night I came home from the set of Falcare to set up the show. Well, they changed a lot of things around without notice, you know, notice before setting things up. And it had to do all these host tools. And I'm sitting here going, oh, dear goodness, right? So I'm up, like, literally falling asleep at my computer. And I don't think I went to bed last night till 5 o'clock in the morning. I'm like, oh, no. I'm like, this is just crazy because I went straight from the Falcare film set, which we're going to have a I'm half asleep talking, teaser trailer for Falcare pretty soon. I'm very psyched and pumped about it. We've been working on this film for so long. And just a quick little thing to give a shout out for Bruce Martin, who I've had on the show before. He actually, here's the deal, needs some help moving some of our inventory to make room for a large order to be delivered on Tuesday for our annual charity-based seminar. So we're asking everyone we know to help by simply selling 10 charity-based packages that are being put together. It's an urban Warrior shirt and water bottle koozie. It will be sold for $25 just so we'll move quickly. If everyone we ask to help does then, we will dwindle our inventory down to just enough to fill small future local orders. May we count on your support. All profits from sales will be donated straight to victims of domestic violence, so selling point can be that the buyers can write off the $25. Some may not want to deal with it, while others, like us, will take that as a write-off, as every little bit helps and add up by the year's end. Also, we will publish buyers' names, companies' names on our website, Facebook, and Twitter pages, which will stay on Charitable Supporters page forever. Thank you. Simply reply to the text, and there's something that I had got just a few minutes before on my phone here. It's World Martial Arts Hall of Famer member, six-time world champion and creator of Tactical Jeet Kune Do, Sifu Bruce Gunny Martin, will personally deliver upon request autograph any purchase items. And you would go, it's from the Warrior team, and you can go to Urban Warriors or, you know, check out Bruce Martin's page. So anyway, I have a great guest today, and you guys know how I do. I never, ever wanted to be Barbie. I've always wanted to be a ninja. And I'm so super pumped because I get these great guests come on the show. Now you know why I'm trying to raise funds for a building, you know, became on board as advisor of the Hollywood Stuntman Hall of can't even talk. I'm trying to sit here drinking coffee. I came on advisor, the board of advisors for the Hollywood Stuntman's Hall of Fame because I'm looking to help, you know, with all get a building, a museum for memorabilia, not just from the past, but I'm here to help out, you know, present and, you know, to help out with future stunt people to help honor them. So anyway, I do see I'd like to bring, I think I have a call on there. So ladies and gentlemen, let me bring my call on.
Hello,
caller. You're on the air.
Hi there. It's Jesse Johnson here.
Hi, Jesse. Thank you, and welcome to the Shelly Nunchuk Show. Thank you.
How's it going?
So can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine, yeah.
Okay, because there was a big truck going on. Every time I show, I get it right in the beginning. There's always sirens go by, and it's kind of funny because I, you know, I live in an area that's kind of quiet, but every time, right on the shelf, sirens go by, trucks go by, and I'm like, it's just perfect timing. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. 100%. The same when you're making low-budget movies, I'm afraid.
Yeah. It's crazy. But anyway, how is your Sunday doing?
It's good. It's good. It's usual nothingness, but all very good. Nice to talk to you and to meet you.
Oh, same here. I'm so happy, and I feel very blessed that I get to have people like yourself on my show because I always say I've never wanted to be Barbie growing up. I've always wanted to be a ninja, and finding out you worked on great stunts. And before getting into stunts and such, can you tell our viewers and such, I mean, how did you get into it? I mean, were you interested in acting stunts? How did you fall into working on films and stunts? Did you get into-
I was obsessed with making movies since beyond I have real memories. The first memories were to do with visiting film sets. I come from, I guess I'm about the third generation of my family, which is pretty crazy because I'm pretty old, and I think film was a pretty new thing when my grandfather started out. But I have uncles who are in the business, and so as I was growing up, I was very, very lucky in that I could visit film sets. I could see that. We were talking about it the other day. To this day, when I smell fiberglass being put together, it reminds me of visiting Pinewood Studios as a 7-year-old, a 6-year-old, and, you know, went on the Superman set, the original Superman, visited Krull and Legend and all these pictures that my uncle was stunt coordinating. And so I would I have those memories as, and linking the smell of fiberglass with a magical place, which is probably pretty dangerous if you're... But to this day, it brings forth magical thoughts for me, and it really was a wonderful childhood of sort of skipping school and hanging out at Pinewood or Shepparton or wherever he was filming and watching what was going on. And, at 14, left high school and carried his stunt bags on Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, which was the third of the pictures they made in England, and sort of, you know, basically followed him around for free, you know, getting him a coffee whenever he needed it. And he had done a stunt where he'd overextended, this is Vic Armstrong, he'd overextended his knee. And so he he was in sort of awful pain through the whole thing. So having a 14-year-old there to help carry bags, and you know, I don't think he particularly wanted an assistant. But at that point in his career, it was quite a symbiotic relationship. So it worked out quite well. And sort of, you know, really felt less need for school after about 14 years old and drifted in and out and really didn't get a high school very much, which I don't recommend at all. Anyone should go to school, but I didn't. And it sort of went from there. I, you know, like everyone, I started in as an extra and as a PA, who's basically an extension of in the old days, it was just basically, if you couldn't afford walkie-talkies, you'd have a couple more PAs because, you know, they would transmit dialogue like a Chinese whispers, and you'd eventually get the right message and yell it out, but most of the time you were wrong. And it was a very frustrating position to be in. In those days, you only had one or two sets of beyond the initial walkie-talkie, so it was a frustrating time. Nowadays, they have, you know, everyone has a walkie-talkie, but it was a fun time to come up, you know. And then I thought assistant directing might be the way to go for a while, so I did Shawshank Redemption and Mr. Holland's Opus and Mortal Kombat and worked with some great, great assistant directors and realized that nowadays, if you want to direct, you there's no real path, but certainly assistant directing is not the path that it once was. Assistant directing tends to lead towards producing and unit production managing. So looking around on set, the people that had the most contact and interaction with the cast and with the actors, I felt, with the stunt, you know, stunt coordinator and the second unit director, beyond, you know, above and beyond the actual director himself. And so I decided that might be the smart place to go, and it paid very well, and it was a lot of fun and exciting, and I'd seen a lot of it growing up and be trained, not specifically for that job, but when, you know, when you analyze what it is that you've been doing for the last 5 or 6 years, you know, between motorcycling and martial arts and, mm-hmm. you know, all those kind of exciting adventures, you realize they all sort of have pretty good training for stunt work. So I honed it and got in there, and it was a wonderful, wonderful career. If you can keep working, it's a blessed way to make a living. It's, you know, some of the greatest people around, and there's an awful lot of thought and calculation that goes on behind the stunts now. It's not at all sort of gung-ho. You know, there's always that element. There's always that one stunt where you turn up, it's like, God, dang it, you're gonna bite down on it. Hope you don't hurt yourself, but for the most part, it's a fantastically rewarding job because you have to come up with a way of performing something and doing it with full gusto and full energy and in character, but doing it again and again, you know, as many times as the director may need. You don't want to ever do something where you can only do the stunt once. That's an accident, not a stunt. But it is a wonderful job, and it's also far more in line with arrive on set. You basically have to get the cast and the crews and the producers' confidence in you and the director's confidence in you, and you have to get them to drink your Kool-Aid. You know, you have to get them to believe what it is you're telling them is safe and good. And really, that's not too far removed from being a director, where you're trying to get them to trust you and believe you. You know, so it was, you know, if you can put your mind in that sort of groove, it's very, very similar to directing and a really, really good place to learn. I think that's why more and more we're seeing directors, really good directors, come from the stunt, you know, the stunt world. You know, it's far more so than any other role on the set. I believe you are dealing with the first team and with those strange, you know, actors are a little like racehorses. They're very highly strung and they require, you know, quite a lot of handling for the most part. There's a few that are very down to earth, but for the most part, they are not like the rest of us. You know. And there's a way of talking to them, a way of getting their confidence, a way of building trust. And it's a really good way to sort of learn that.
Stunt people, right? See, for me, always people like yourself with the stunts have always had much respect. And it's something like when you were just mentioning, you know, like listening to everything, because I love the stories you guys are able to tell me. And when you said that, you mentioned Crawl. And I knew exactly what that film is. And I just like going back, and I know the lead actor was Ken Marshall. And I remember him, you know, rescuing the princess, and he had that star. It was like, it wasn't a ninja star, but I think of it in my head, and then it was, you know, that thing he threw, and I was like, you really worked on that? And I'm going, I saw that in the movie
No, I didn't work on it. I visited the set. I was too young.
Well,
I'm not that old.
Visited the set, and it's like, you visited the set where I started in the movie theater, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it, just the premise of it, and it's just a beautiful story, and it's like, it had me in tears, you know, like, remember the Cyclops, and he had the one eye, and they foretold, like, he could foretell his future, and it's like all the things. It was a beautiful story. I mean, I loved it.
That's good. I mean, those films were made on such a grand scale. It was so much fun to visit them as a child. The film itself, you know, it has its fans. But it was directed by one of my favorite directors. That's the other reason for remembering it. It was Peter Yates who directed a film called Bullet, which is absolutely instrumental in forming, you know, my love of movies and action movies, particularly, you know, I'm glad you were touched by that one. But no, I didn't work on it at all. I think I was 12 or 13 years old, so it was really just visiting it the magical sort of environment that those sets represented. You have, you know, they spanned over four or five of these huge studios, and you know, just all the craftsmen, you know, the British Union crew working like crazy to make it this incredible world. And you know, for someone who, you know, for a teenager who pretty much lives in a fantasy world most of the time anyway, that is the most wonderful place to grow up and be a part of. I remember at the time I don't think we went to the actual theater much, because at that time it was expensive, and I don't think I had an awful lot of money, but I had the opportunity to visit the set more than I had to actually go to the theater, which was sort of a strange conundrum, but there you go.
It must have been beautiful, you know, I mean, me watching the films, but you actually to be there. You must have been like, you know, a kid in the candy store, and you must have been like, you know, just like drooling being on these sets. And I was like, man, I wish I was there, because, I mean, most things, yeah, I mean, it's a lot different. I mean, still the technology, but just to see it back then where I've known CG and everything's grown, I still love
it. Yeah, I think that was the difference. You know, less was left to, you know, the first films I remember it being the shortcut taken on was Mortal Kombat, where they simply didn't build part of a set. I remember watching it. They put a blue screen in and said, no, we'll build that later in CG. And it was the first time I realized it. It was sort of the change, you know. I mean, you know, in many respects, it's a good thing. Listen, you know, there's so much waste on a film set. You know, in those days, there were rooms and built and painted and put together and that were never filmed. It's just like, you know, it was all thrown away, and it's a terrible, terrible waste when you think of it environmentally and, you know, and for the planet. But then, you know, then there's something wonderful about it as well too, you know, that there was that opulence, that there was still a world where things were, you know, were layered on like some kind of czarist, you know, incredible, you know, place. But it was fascinating to see that and catch the very end of that time. But I think there are still films made that are extraordinarily opulent and over the top. But you know, only a handful of directors can sort of, you know, call on that. But I think it's also a good thing that, you know, you start to use your head and do things differently anyway. If you someone like Christopher Nolan, who's a genius with miniatures and, you know, all those incredible sets, a lot of them you think you're seeing, you know, they're not CG, but you think you're seeing them in actual fact, they're half scale or, you know, sixth scale. And, you know, it's incredible to do that and still, aware of how to make something look huge, but in actual fact, not spending vast amounts of money. So there are ways to do it, and there are people that are still doing it, but, you know, it was pretty cool. It was a pretty cool way to grow up, and it really, really left a mark on me, and I, as far back as I can remember, I wanted to make movies, and it was never really a question of what the end goal was, but always and still is a question of how to get there, you know, and what the best route was, and you know, am I wasting time? Should, you know, film school? And I think everyone, you know, who wants to get into movies, who wants to direct, who wants to make their own mark, faces that same dilemma every day. You know, are we doing it the right way? Am I wasting time to get film school? Do you postgraduate? Do you go off and say to hell with it and spend, you know, the family savings and all of your friends' savings and try and make a movie, you know, and is that the right way? And I think you just have to trust your gut instinct. You have to look at the films that you love, and you have to look at the artists, you know, the filmmakers who you love, and you know, read about as many as you can and see the path they took. For me, film school wasn't an option because there wasn't money for it. You know, I got into two or three, and then, you know, but you know, we can't survive. You know, there's no way I'm going to pay the tuition, so it wasn't even a question. I had to make my own movies and had to go out and raise financing to make them, and you know, and find people that would be interested in backing films. You know, whether it was an actor who wanted to back a movie about himself starring in a role or whatever, and you find your path. You know, it is interesting. You know, whether you know if you can get inside that studio system or you stay outside it your entire career, you know, and never get noticed. It's the interesting thing that I think most people don't realize is when a film goes badly, it doesn't get bad reviews. When a film goes badly, it gets no reviews. It vanishes. There's no noise at all, and that's the most heartbreaking part of this business. You know, bad reviews, at least someone's noticed you. At least someone went to see the film. But the terrible, terrible truth is only a handful of films ever get seen. You know, there are so many that just vanish into the ether, and a lot of them are good. You know, it takes such a lot of energy to not only make that film, but then nurture it and take it out into the marketplace, and you know, get it sold to the right distributor, get the distributor to handle it right. It's an incredible, incredible business. It really is very, very multifaceted.
So, Jesse, you said that, you know, I mean, you've been doing stunts for many years. How did you get into, you know, like stunts? How did you get into your first film? Did you have training? Because I know with stunts, from personal experience myself, from being, you know, doing things, to have a little training and almost kind of being physically fit. I mean, how did you get into the stunts?
I trained like hell as a martial artist in England. I loved martial arts. I fought competitively for a few years, and I had one professional fight that was over extraordinarily quickly, and then I didn't realize that wasn't in it for me, but I'm glad I did the one. But I've always loved the martial arts, loved cross training and training different styles. So that was there, and then there was an awful lot of running and motorcycles. And in England, they have the stunt register, which is you can't work in stunts until you have stunt register, which is a pretty cool way of doing it. I mean, as well as a certain level of training amongst all the stunt guys. And so I trained for that. You know, until I decided I wanted to leave England and pursue films in the United States. When I came here, it was assistant directing to start with, because that was the easiest, you know, that was the way that it seemed to work quickest for me to get working and paying my bills. And then at some point, I made the break to stunting. And in America, it's a little easier. You have a SAG card, and you can basically hang your shingle out and say, I'm a stuntman. So it was not. It was not so much a case of how did I start selling myself as a stuntman as to you know, how long you can keep working for, because you keep training and you're of a level that people want to hire you, and you're someone that's a valuable, you know, team player on set as a stuntman. You have skills that you have a skill set that is valuable to them as a coordinator. And so I started, you know, working with a handful of coordinators and proving what I could do. And really, for the last 15, 20 years, it's been the same five or six coordinators that, when I'm between jobs as a director, have given me a call and brought me in. And you know, you nurture those relationships, and you prove yourself, you know, useful to them, and reliable and trustworthy. And it's really not as complex a thing as people think. You train hard. You try to keep it to 3-4 days a week or more, and you keep a certain level of training up, you know, it's good. I mean, you know, having a very rounded knowledge of how it all works helps. But at the end of the day, as you know, a lot of times it's about hitting the ground and making it look like it really hurt. Yeah. And you know, a certain level of acting and a certain level of there's also obviously, you know, you reciprocate with that group of coordinators. You make sure you hire them whenever you can and put them in for jobs whenever you can, and it goes backwards and forwards, and that's really ultimately what the survival as a stuntman comes down to. And being professional and being good at your work. It took a long, long time, a lot of hustling, driving to different people, different coordinator sets, you know, with your in the old days, with your headshot under your arm and resume there, and sort of shaking hands. And you know, it's grueling and excruciating sometimes, and some guys make you feel fantastic about it. Other guys, you get in your car and drive away with a rain cloud above your head, you know. I just grabbed that. Yeah. But that's the nature of it. You do it, and it's all you know. You have to treat it as a job, and you know, we would get the location breakdown. You know, maybe myself and a friend or on my own, you'd get the location breakdown, find out where various films are filming that day from the location permit office, look to see who was coordinating them, if there was someone you knew or you had some kind of a string relationship to, you know, some kind of a string that you say, oh, I've worked with so-and-so, thought I'd come out, say hello. And you'd mark them off on the Thomas Guide, which is the old form of the GPS. It's called a map. It's an amazing thing. You'd mark them all off on that around a, you know, around a sort of 30-mile or 40-mile zone, and you'd do it. It would take you till about 2 in the afternoon, and that was your day's work. You'd come back and then train a little bit, you know, and you know, as I say, 3-4 days a week. It could burn you out, so you didn't want to do it too often. But eventually, if you were positive, enthusiastic, and optimistic, something would come, you know, and you'd work, and that day on a film set would pay for the last 2 weeks of sort of hustling and eating pizza, whatever cheap food was available at the time. And he did it, and it had to be done. There was a few years of that, and that was the break into it, really, you know. But I was also very lucky in that I had uncles that were working in the business, and when at the time they were living in England, but if they'd come over and do a film, I'd try and get a few weeks on that, and that'd be great too, you know. But it's an exciting way for a young person to make a living. You hope that as you get into your late 30s and 40s, you've eked out some kind of a foothold where you don't have to hustle quite so hard like that, but it's still a hustle. And as a director, it's a hustle, and the movie industry itself is a hustle. You know, if you read any of the books by, you know, any of these great directors, it was a hustle right to the end. You know, Elia Kazan, who's one of my favorite directors, said the meek shall inherit the earth, but not in Hollywood. You know, it's worthwhile remembering things like that. It's a game about self-promotion.
Yeah, that's true.
Almost the right answer?
Yeah. It's interesting to hear people, how they get into and stuff, because it's like, getting that out there, and people that I know that want to get into it, and it says, you know, finding out these answers and trying to pass it on to my listeners, because I know even in the archives, people listen to my show, and people ask me, well, how did I get into it? And it says, you know, where I'm doing indie films, I worked on a couple of big movie sets, but it's mostly like indie films. And it says, you know what, I want to bring the people that are successful in their own way, like, and let them tell us their own stories. So it's here saying it's amazing. Everybody has a different story. And it's like, to find your own path. I mean, you did it a different way, you know?
There's people that simply got very, very good in a particular style, you know, whether it's motorcycling or parkour or martial arts. And they got called. They kept getting called, you know, and they told me no. I sat at home and the phone rang, and you know, I never actually hustled, and people just kept calling me, and you know what, fantastic, and that's awesome, and I love to hear that, but brother, that wasn't the way for me. If I'd waited for the telephone call to ring, I would have starved, and you know, I don't know what I've had to do, join the army maybe, which is what I'd always wanted to do anyway, but it's for me, it was always and always has been about self-promotion, getting out there, hustling, pushing, going to the party, and not being overt about how you sell yourself, because that's an ugly thing and not a pleasant thing, and you don't want to be that guy that's too pushy, but putting yourself in front of people, you know, and for me it was also, you know, thinking about yin and yang, and you know, the more you push in one direction, it eventually pushes back and you get something in turn, you know. Good energy out and good energy coming back in, and you know, you'd start to hustle in the morning when you're going to take your headshots out that day, and you'd have a coffee or whatever it took to put a positive spin on yourself and make you cheerful, and because that would rub off on everyone that you met. And if you're angry and bitter and you know, had road rage, by the time you got there was no chance you were going to get a job, because it was bad karma was seeping out of your pores, you know. So you know, without getting too cosmic awareness and ramblize, you have to have a positive mental outlook on, and I think you have to do it in any job that's a social based job, and filmmaking is a very, very social based job. You're interacting with people every step of the way, and when you're on a film set, you're interacting with people. They're all around you, they can pick up on it. Doesn't mean you have to be gregarious and, you know, and loud and telling jokes all the time and life of the party, but you do have to know how to fit into that sort of jigsaw, that pattern, you know, that thing, become that, you know, that person that's the people want there, you know, that's going to make the day go go better, you know, feel a little brighter. problem solved. That's just that little easier, you know. And it's not for everyone. It really isn't. You know, I've worked with so many people, Shelley, who are enormously talented, and it's broken my heart because they just can't operate within the environment of a film set. You know, they can't. You know, and I've watched them, and I've tried to bring them into it, and you know, you'd be fantastic. Just keep, and they're like, nah, and they're whining, and you just see it's, you know, they need more regulation. They need more stability, and it's just not there in movies. It's a certain, you know, have a certain carny mindset as well at the back of it all, because it's all going to end, you know, in a couple of months, and you're going to be unemployed again. You have to be hustling again, and a lot of people can't face that, and they don't really honestly want that, you know. But for other people, it's the only way that can work. For me, for one, you know. You know, even when I do a film that goes on for too long, by the end, you're like, oh God, when's this going to end? And you think, what am I thinking this for? I'm making all this money. But it's just, you know, it's something.
Yeah, no, it's stressful. I do know that, because it's magic. How everybody makes a film on the screen, it's magic. But behind the scenes, from what I'm told, because I'm non-union, and, you know, if I'm on there and I get picked, you know, for a part to do, the other thing that I think, when I go there, I mean, not to bother people and, you know, just chill out and sit and wait, but with indie film, the thing that I think to do is try to lend a hand to someone else, because I don't think it's beneath me if, like, they want me to hold a boom mic, if they can set it for me, I'll hold it, you know, as long as I can hold it on and pitch in. If they need me, you know, to go pick up stuff, like food and stuff, if they send me things, like become multitasker on a set to lend a hand.
Because
if I'm just around, it's like you're waiting, but, you know, help put on some makeup or something.
The two worlds are so vividly different. I mean, you know, over the last year or two, I did the package with Dolph Lundgren and Stone Cold Steve Austin, which is a wonderful, wonderful experience. I worked with the union crew, you know, in Canada, and it was a fantastic film, very, very good, with absolutely the best, most experienced and professional crew you could imagine, and it was joyful. I loved it, I felt the film itself was steered a little bit too much by the foreign sales, which means that, you know, I was not the final decision maker with script, with editorial, with things like that. It turned out well, and we enjoyed it, and I had a great editor on it who was tremendous. But when I walked away from the film, I felt it didn't represent the kind of movie I had come 5,000 miles from the UK to make. So I went out and raised some money independently and started shooting. I shot two shorts and you know, to make sure I was not out of my mind. And then raised the money to do a feature, and we shot in black and white. It's very artistic based. There's some action in it, but it's really a character performance driven piece. It's Romeo and Juliet set in the LA underworld, and it represents a very, very different kind of movie. It's an incredible accomplishment. I'm absolutely thrilled with the way it's coming together. But it was I worked with people, you know, in many positions on that crew who'd never been on a film set before. So there was a certain level, you know, learning curve every single day where you're bringing people up to a certain level, and everyone chipped in, everyone picked up sandbags, everyone, you know, wonderful, wonderful people went and picked up lunch, you know, people all over the place were chipping in to make it work. We had maybe 15 people on the crew, and that's how you work at that level. But the two, you know, that and the union crew are a chasm apart. You literally cannot, you know, you are not allowed to move a C-stand on the union crew. It's obviously bad to fall on someone and hurt them, obviously, and jump in and move it, but it's not something that you would ever be asked to do or ever be expected to do. And if you did without being asked to do it, it would probably be your last day if you were an extra or someone that was simply getting, you know, because, you know, that's something that's a union-protected position, and you would be seen as encroaching on their livelihood to, you know, even you know, in the smallest degree, and I understand both ends, but yeah, no, you're right. On the indie level, everyone chips in. It's a lot more sort of let's put on a show, you know, and a lot of fun. And you get a few really, really good come out of it. And within a few months, they're working on big budget movies, and they're working out how to handle it. Some of the people on the lower budget movies never actually make that move, and they stay making low-budget movies for their career, maybe because they enjoy that, they prefer that environment, that's slightly less regulated, but, you know, or they can manage to survive you know, with their bills because they're so low. But it's an interesting thing. You know, within a space of 6 months, I went from you know, a union crew to the absolute beginning sort of, you know, entry level crew, and they were both wonderful. They both had great sort of things. You know, you're not dealing with any preconceptions when you're working with people who've never done it before, which is fun. It's also infuriating at times, but you take a breath and you watch what's going on, and you sort of, you know, you shot this and you prepare your day accordingly. But yeah, you know, it's interesting. I if you're working on a big show as a stunt performer or an extra, I would certainly not recommend trying to get involved and help in any other departments without being asked specifically to do it. And now, if you're working on an indie film, it's quite the opposite, because you may end up that movie with a producer credit and, you know, replacing someone, and you know, it may be the start of your above the line career. So I think it goes back to being able to judge your situation and being able to look at it and figure out very, very quickly, now, is this somewhere I should step in, or is this somewhere I should just hang back and watch and be an observer? Because very often the difference between moving up in the business and sort of getting anywhere is the ability to know when to talk and when to keep your mouth shut. It's a delicate balance at times as well. But it really is an important thing, discretion, you know.
There's rules. I get what you're saying, because I know, like, on a big sets, right, they have a thing where you're not supposed to take pictures above the actors, right? And I worked on set of, like, I was just an actor.
I just real quick, I mean, I have that rule on my sets, and they're small sets. I mean, absolutely, absolutely important for me. No cameras, no photographs. It's extraordinarily important now with Facebook, and especially if you have a low-budget movie that you're trying to bring into the marketplace with actors who've done things before, you can destroy your advanced publicity by photos being leaked onto Facebook. No, for sure. And on big movies, absolutely. You know, I understand it 100%.
Mm-hmm. Like, it's a different story if you're, like, you're away, because sometimes, you know, I hear the actors, like, cheesing up, like, Mel Gibson and some, they're like, yeah, let's take some pictures, but it's, like, you're not really on set, it's, like, after set, and it's, like, when they're saying, hey, let's do it, that's a different story, but when you're working, you're supposed to be, you know, you're not supposed to bother people, and it's, like, that's the thing, knowing on set, you have to be reliable, you know, you have to be respectful, and you're there to do a job. And that's what, you know, you're getting paid for to do. And that's what I do realize. But, you know, I've seen things, I'm going, oh, God. I see people post things from certain film sets, and I'm going, oh, they're not supposed to be doing that. But, you know, I just keep my mouth shut if it's not for me to say anything, you know. And if you build up a reputation like myself, you know, being respectful to when the directors, you know, there to do your job. So I get that 100%. And sometimes, like, I don't really realize, because I'm learning, and with certain things, when I see something on the public, you know, out there on the internet, I'm like, okay, maybe this is okay to post. So I'm going, and people saying, oh, no, don't post this or that, and I don't realize things, and I go, oh, okay, because I'm trying to learn, you know, rules and regulations. I'm still kind of a newbie. So I never do anything on purpose. I'm like, okay, I understand now. So you know what I mean, right, with what I'm talking about, certain things, right?
I think if there's ever any doubt at all, things. I mean, for the most part, it's important to remember we're in a very, very competitive business, the selling of movies, to getting people to see movies, to getting them to talk about it. And the internet, you know, it's a marketing tool. And the wonderful thing is everyone has access to the absolute killer, dreadful thing is everyone has access to it. You know, each photo that's released by a film studio, by an indie producer has been thought about, has been calculated, is going out there to try and do something towards promoting that movie. And yeah, absolutely. If you've signed an NDA which says I agree not to put information or photos on the internet, you absolutely shouldn't. You know, it's a business. For that 5 minutes of glory you get on your social media, you could have just ruined some poor guy's chance of actually recouping some of his money in his movie, because there's no surprise to it anymore. No, I understand it 100%, and it's just one of the more modern hurdles that we have to deal with you know, with releasing and getting these films out there. As I say, it's an extraordinarily difficult thing to get an independent film into the zeitgeist, into the world in a way that people notice it. 99.9% of indie films just vanish. They're the tree that falls down in the forest. You simply don't hear about. They're gone. And because you're competing against enormous marketing machines, mm-hmm. which have vast sums of money to put behind these pictures, and they are fighting a fight with no gloves on. They're fighting with no rules. They will quash you in any mm-hmm. way they can if they feel you're competitive with them. You know, killer sites like IMDb that have the score ratings, you don't think that the studio has a room, has a network of 300-400 people that bump up your rating. You know, at command, they're called slush groups, and they pay people to do it. They've got interns that do this. You're mm-hmm. going out there with a movie, and you're wondering why, you know, suddenly there's an influx of stuff against you, or an influx of stuff in your favor, or why another film is getting, you know, 20,000 hits and you haven't had yours. You know, you have to wake up and smell the coffee. You're competing against, you know, vast machines with people that understand how to how to market through the internet, and it's extraordinarily difficult to release a, you know, to get an indie film out there. So yeah, no, I get it 100%. You know, you've got to protect it. You know, protect your publicity in any way you can, and try and control it. But then other low budget movies, maybe they want every single piece of, you know, every photo yeah. they can out there.
You're reading my mind, because a lot of people see with me, because now I'm getting to do like little bit promotions. I have my radio show. The plus with me is like when I'm on a set where I just did a Central Realism, and the thing that happened, I thought I was going to get cut. I ended up playing the head boss ninja, and I got to wear my Kato costume. Thank you so much. I didn't realize. I thought I was going to get cut more because the head boss ninja, I mean, these people were more advanced. So they were all guys. I was the only girl ninja there. And about two guys didn't show up. So they're like, you know, one of my other film brothers, Bill Freytrain McLean, he's like, oh, Shelly, you know, this chill out. So I said, okay, this is a beautiful day. And I'm thinking, oh, well, you know what? I'm going to get cut out of the scene. I may as well just eat and sit and meditate. And so they go, come on, Shelly, come here. And I'm like, hey, head boss ninja, come here. And it didn't dawn on me what they said to me. And I have, you know, basic beginner martial arts skills. And here I am, and I'm going, in my Kato costume with my bow staff, and they're going, okay, Shelly, here are the four heels. You're going to take this one out, this one out. And I'm like, what? And it didn't dawn on me, you know, just hanging out and just chilling and being, you know, sitting there going, oh, my gosh, really? So they had it was on the spot. And everybody else was like, you know, they were prepared. The other ninjas were fighting and each other preparing before their shoot. And I had to do it right on the spot. And I'm going, oh, crap. Oh, crappy crap. And so we had to get, like, you know, it's just like one of those things. And the thing is, I get to talk, you know, about it, and it's like get to promote my scene. Now, I wasn't really a lead, but doing the promotions, it's like these films that I'm part of, they like me talking about it, you know, part of the scene. I mean, I can't say about the whole plot, but here I am talking about it, and it's because being part of it and then loving what I do, because I'm like, yeah, ninja, and that's what fans love too, because then they can relate, know that I'm not just saying it because I'm in the film, because I really love it. I love ninjas, and I was in my Kato costume, and I dedicated that because this is the anniversary passing of Bruce Lee and Brandon Lee, and I wanted to do a little something, so I go, this is for Bruce Lee. I'm doing this in my Kato costume, you know, dedicated to Bruce Lee. So it's something where, you know, promoting stuff in my own way, some people do like it in the indie films. And they say, yeah, Shelly, go ahead, talk about it. But it's only if they want me to talk about it. So it goes both ways. So I'm trying to be careful, but if they gave me the okay, I'm going to blab about it everywhere.
Cool.
So, you know, I'm trying to learn.
Yeah, no, yeah, just check with the filmmakers, I guess. That sounds very exciting.
Yeah, and what because I wanted to make sure, because on like looking at the IMDb page, there's certain ones like I wanted to talk about, because I think there was one that's okay to talk about. I was looking at the very first Thor. It says the God of Thunder, Thor. Are you able to talk about that one?
Thanks. So. Yeah, the one that's come out. Yeah, no, totally. I was a stunt performer on that. That was my cousin James Armstrong, the stunt coordinator. That is awesome and coming up. And then Vic Armstrong and Andy were first and second unit. Andy was first unit coordinator and Vic was the second unit director. And so it was quite a family affair. Vic has been an enormous inspiration in my life, and it's I think just one of the classiest and coolest cats out there. And I'm very, very lucky to have been able to sort of pick up a few of his breadcrumbs that he's dropped once in a while.
I'm sitting there, and I have to be honest, because it's like, even though I sit with someone, you know, like yourself, and it's like, because I was saying before, and it's like, you know how people always say, give something a chance, okay, because I was looking at it, and this is what I was saying about the lead actor. He's adorable. What is his name, the lead actor of Thor?
Chris Hemsworth.
And I was going, why does he look like a surfer, dude? And I kept saying this, right? And it's like, I love stunts and stuff like that. And people are like, oh, Shelly, you got to give it a chance and blah, 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 this and that. So I finally saw Thor, and I'm going, well, I actually really liked it because I'm very critical about my stunt stuff. And I was like, I liked Sif. I was just like that, and now here I am, you know, after getting all the fact, well, I kind of really liked the film, and I went to see part two. And I had a ball and seeing it part two in 3D, and I was like, here I am now after getting, like, liking Thor. You actually worked on a film set, and it's like, the universe keeps bringing me these incredible people like yourself on my film. So and you can't see because it's radio, but when you're telling me things, my jaw is to the floor. So I'm sitting going, wow, this is really cool. What did you, like, what stunts did you do on Thor? Were you stunting any particular actor?
I was an ice monster. I was the one that fought with Sif, and then I doubled Stellan Skarsgård, and I played a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent for the rest of it. And so I got to do quite a lot. I was there for almost the full duration, and jumping around and bouncing around. Nothing epic on that one. Not that I've done anything epic ever, but there was a lot of sort of, you know, tumbling and fighting. It was fun though. It was extraordinary. I mean, the biggest hurdle with, you know, the monster part was less the fighting. The fighting I actually enjoyed doing, but, you know, it was a lot of makeup and body. You know, you had the muscle suit and then contact lenses, mm-hmm. teeth, and then prosthetic face. So you know, for an 8 a.m. cool time, you know, shooting cool time, the makeup cool for me would be 2:30 a.m. in the morning, so there's not an awful lot of sleep, and then you're in the outfit, and you obviously can't, you've got the rubber hands on, so you can't eat, and you've got, mm-hmm. you know, the face on, so you don't really want to eat anyway, so you just sort of, you exist in this strange sort of netherworld of lying on a sofa on your side in the dark room until you're actually cooled, and then you go in, you do your thing, and then you come back out again, like down again. They were long, long days, 20-hour days, and, you know, so you have to conserve your energy in the suit, because when you are cooled in, you want to have your full energy, be able to do the fight scene and, you know, not hurt anyone, be specific, see your marks. And it's an interesting thing. It takes a mindset. It's not for everyone. You know, I think over my career, I've seen maybe four stuntmen who've had the full prosthetic on, who've simply said, you know what, I can't do this. We're done. We had two people on tour that ended up leaving because they didn't want the full makeup on. It was just too much. Then I did a film called Galaxy Quest a few years earlier, and we'd had a stuntman on that just literally come and say, nah, I'm done, I'm sorry. And it was 11 o'clock, he just got the makeup on, you know, literally 40 minutes of wearing it. It's like, no, and you just have to respect them, because it's, you know, they don't like it, you know. And so the makeup came off, and we were on the telephone again trying to find someone else to come in and do the stunt that day. And I've run into it a few times. It's just not for everyone. It's a strange thing, because you have this stuff stuck to your face completely. You've got a contact lens on, false teeth, and then this huge, huge wardrobe. And in many cases, you might have your arms, you know, glued down behind your back or down to your side. It's not for everyone. It's quite claustrophobic. And it's, you know, so you have to find that sort of comfortable space in your mind, because it was a long, you know, we trained for, I think, something like 2 months. And then, you know, the scene itself was probably 3 weeks or 4 weeks. So you're, you know, by the midway through the second week, you're really sort of thinking, wow, this is not something I'd really want to do for my entire career, but I love the money. But then once the fight goes, you forget all that stuff, and you're there, and you're jumping around, and you're having a blast because that's what you enjoy doing. You're trained to do it, and you know you're in the moment. You're watching everything. You're living for those moments. And that, for me, is where stunts becomes one of the most wonderful careers in the whole world. Is when you're actually in that moment and living and watching for the cue, watching for your moment, your mark, and it is an incredible, fun way, you know, and vital way to make a living. You know, all these people relying on you to get from there to there to there, you know, and do it without tripping over or hurting anyone, and making it exciting, and then repeat it. You know, it's cool. And as I say, once you get on set, that's easy because you're there and you've got your mind on other things. But it's the moments between the shooting on a film like that we have the full prosthetic on that can be a bit. But it's all memory soon enough, and it's all behind you. So.
It is a lot of work because I've done, I get into films, right, and I worked with Director Z, who I'm working with now on Valkyr, and he actually used me as multi-characters, and, you know, I put on the full makeup, you know, from head to toe and looking like a monster. You know what I love? I don't know if you liked it with what I'm going to say, is when I'm working on set and when guys and girls that are working there and they're saying, well, who's that? And they don't realize it's me. It's such a compliment because you're transforming yourself. And when people can't recognize me or, you know, go into a premiere and they're like, that's Shelley Nunchucks. And it's like, it's awesome because that's what I think part of acting is. When you become something that you're not and then people look at you and go, that's you? That's you over there? You know, it's kind of like, it's awesome. And it's, you know, I could sit there and say, yeah, maybe, you know, getting really into shape, getting real buffed and run around half naked, right, which would probably be a good advantage. But sitting there and the best compliments for me, you know, dressing up as a ninja and having the monster makeup and then people going, that's you, Shelley. So, you know, I don't know if you get that awesome rush where people going, that's you? Has anybody ever said that to you when you had makeup on and stuff like that? Has anybody ever said to you, Jesse, you go, hey, that's you?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, it's a lot of the time no one recognizes you. I'm not so sure it's such a compliment to me because I know the guys very well that put all the hard work into putting the makeup on, you know, but yeah, I mean, you know, that it's certainly easier to have no inhibitions when you're covered in and when you have the full makeup on. But then the important thing is also to be able to immerse yourself in a character where, you know, as a stunt person, even when there is less makeup, and it's one of the things that a lot of people forget about, is the ability to act is extraordinarily important. I have about 4 or 5 stuntmen that I work every movie pretty much. Mm-hmm. It worries me sometimes because they keep turning up in all my movies, but they're people that I can trust, you know, to bring a performance to their bad guy or their tough guy or whomever, because there's nothing worse than, you know, you go through the stunt book, you know, the stunt player's directory, and you see these guys with great faces, and it's like, oh, great, another good bad guy. We bring him in, and the guy can't act. You know, he can't remember lines. He can't hit his mark. He looks stiff. He sticks his shoulders out, puffs his chest up as soon as you say rolling. It's like, well, you know, and he's so disappointed. So I have a group of about 4 or 5 guys that I just keep going back to who are great. They remember the lines, hit the mark, and they're good actors and terrific ground pounders as well. They'll hit the ground hard and make it look like a mess and not pleasant, you know. Acting is an incredibly important part of being a stuntman, you know, and you know, a lot of these guys have taken acting lessons. They may or may not at one time have wanted to be actors in their own right, but certainly they keep a level of training up, which just makes our job so much easier as a coordinator or as a director, because, you know, you've got to blend in, you've got to understand the script, you've got to understand the part you're playing, you've got to do a little bit of your, you know, have a little bit of backstory and be ready to go, you know. And it's, you know, it's all very well to be able to do a 720 and you know, a standing backflip and be, you know, the parkour champion. But if you can't act worth a damn, then you know, really, really not much use to me as a stuntman, I've got to say, unfortunately. And it's a cruel thing to say because you know, for me, I prefer the guy that blends in, understands the character, and is maybe not such a great athlete, If he's a fantastic actor, it's wonderful too, but if that ability to act and to be a part of the scene and to make the audience believe you're there, that's really, really a part of it all. It's a wonderful job, you know. It's much more of a consideration than most people give it credit for. And a lot of these great character stunt players I've worked, when I've had to give them more dialogue, they've been awesome with it. Really, really good, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Surprisingly good, you know. Because, you know, you've got to remember they've had a career for years and years saying a line here, a line there, and making it sell. So when you actually do give them a bit more dialogue, they're pretty good with it, you know. Also a pleasant surprise. Those are the stunt guys I love working with, you know. An ability to act is important.
Yeah, I was going to say that the ability, and also knowing, too, that, you know, with stunt people, too, the other thing is I always have the one thing that I can do besides, like, improv and stuff, because everything, sometimes you don't know what's going to happen in stunts, and you have to kind of, even though there's a script with stunts and, you know, with lines, you have to be ready for anything. That's what I'm always told. When you go to set, even though there's a script and stuff, always be ready for anything, because if something doesn't work out, they may have to change it up. And I think people that are totally, you know, stuck on scripts, it kind of freaks them out a bit. And I've seen it on set, and it's like it's even harder. And I'm the total opposite. I'm better at improv. I've done dinner theater, comedy improv, and I have great facial expressions. And a lot of watching the action fights and such for many years, I tend to notice stunt people, they have great facial expressions that I love, like their eyeballs and their eyelids and their eyebrows pop up and the facial, they turn really red.
It's amazing. You definitely don't want to overdo it, though, either. If you watch people in a real fighting scenario, you know, if you scan these things that happen, you watch on the news, you realize people emotionally too much until sometime afterwards, you know, it's strange. So I always get a bit off-put if, yeah, I don't like overacting. That's one thing you have to be careful of.
Yes. Mm-hmm. No, I know. Yeah. I know what you're saying.
There's a handful of stunt guys that are also guilty as well. You have to bring them back a little bit. But it's part of the work as a coordinator and a director. It's just you have to watch every facet, because you can pull off a stunt beautifully. The actors can be great in jeopardy. The pyro can work. You know, the breakaways can work. And then you've got one guy at the back, whether he's a stuntman or an extra, who has overdone it, and your eye goes straight to him, you know, and it's awful. We used to have a thing called the Space Invader Walk. It was whenever there was a gunfight, you'd always have one guy that would do this weird kind of sidestep thing, and we called it the Space Invader because you look like one of the old 1980s Space Invaders, and it was terrible, and it was so lame, and we were always complaining, and, oh, no, you did the Space Invader Walk. Well, that's, you know, it became the thing that you ridicule everyone if they accidentally did the Space Invader Walk. I was watching footage from the Iran-Iraq War with actual guys in combat, and I said, there's something that was familiar about all of them. And these guys were doing Space Invader Walk in real combat, and from that point on, it's like, oh, my God, you know, we've been making fun of people for doing this, and this is human reaction to do this when you're shooting or getting shot at. But there you go. The other one like that was waving money in the air during a tournament, and I've directed, you know, a couple of tournament movies where you have the martial arts guys fighting. And I used to get really annoyed at the extras because, you know, we'd give them money and they'd wave the money in the air. I said, no one waves money in the air. You know, these guys would hold on to the money if they're gambling it. They're wanting to gamble. They don't wave money in the air. What's going on? And a few years later, I did a filming back in Bangkok, and we went to Lumpini Stadium and watched one of these big Thai fights. You know, it was quite fun to watch. They have three tiers of audience, you know, divided by wire mesh, you know, the people that pay to be close to the ring, and then the people who can't pay quite so much, and then the people who, you know, who pay pennies to be there, who are way back on the third, you know, there's nothing happens in the first two rounds, but by the third round, which we learned was the gambling round, it just becomes pandemonium. You can't even hear yourself think, it's so noisy in there. And I looked across to the audience, and sure enough, everyone is waving their money in the air, passing it through the wire to the gamble, you know, to the bookies who are down on the first row. It's absolutely hilarious. It's like all of my preconceptions of, you know, the fact that no one waves money in the air were out the window because everyone was waving big bills, you know, wads of money. And so it's funny, you know, you think certain things don't happen in real life, and if you're sure enough, they do. But having said that, we try and avoid having the Space Invader walk when you're doing a shootout, because it does look lame. It does look wacky, even if they do it in actual combat. It's you try and keep people aware of what's going on. These are real bullets coming. You know, don't stick your chin out and stand like Rambo shooting from the hip. It looks terrible. Even if people do sometimes do it, you're creating a meta reality when you're making a movie. Yes, you're trying to replicate reality, but on the other hand, you want it to look real. And and the strange things that happen in real life, yes, you could argue a case, well, actually I've seen footage of it actually happening. That would be great, but 90% of the audience hasn't seen that footage. They'd watch the movie and go, that looks fake. So, you know, when you're making action, you are seeking to replicate real life, but you're seeking to do it in a way that feels interesting, feels fresh, and feels real. So just because you may have seen videotape of it, as in the Space Invader walk, doesn't mean it's cool to do. It's funny. You try and always do as much research as possible, you know, with action, with what happens in real life. And the thing that we're living in, in a world now where, with YouTube and LiveLeak and all these sort of incredible movie go-to sort of internet, movie channels, is that you know, the audience has a very, very acute sense of what's real and what's not real, what can happen, what can't happen. And you look back at all these great films that influenced us from the 80s, the action movies, and you realize they really wouldn't cut it now. You know, I mean, it's so fake. The fights are so terrible and so corny, and the action was so lame. But we loved them then. But, our grammar, the grammar of filmmaking has evolved in the last 10 or 20 years, and a lot in the action movie, an incredible amount. Because also video games and first-person shooters, cutting-edge pictures like the Bourne movies and films like mm-hmm. Spielberg's Saving Private Ryan really raised the bar, and turned, actually didn't raise it so much as turn it on its head, what to be expected from action, with regard to camera being handheld or crossing the line, the perspective of, the audience perspective, in the old days you only said, the good guys were on this side, the bad guys were on this side. If you put the bad guy shooting left to right, it's going to confuse the audience. Nowadays, they've thrown a lot of those ideas out of the window. John Woo threw them all out of the window. So it doesn't matter, confuse the audience, make it look muddled, and it adds to the sense of jeopardy. We really are in a different era now with regards to action filmmaking. You've got to be aware of what's going on. You've got to do your research. Got to look at what's happening out there. And then you have something come along that throws that on its head, like The Raid or Crouching Tiger, these 10 years earlier, pictures that went against all the rules, were completely fake. You have two little guys hitting each other for 25 punches and one going down, and it looks good. And I've got to say, I enjoyed it. But if we put that in a Western, movie with someone like Stone Cold Steve Austin, and he's having a fight with a guy and it takes him 25 punches to knock the guy down, everyone would be scratching their head saying, what on earth is this garbage? It's very, very interesting. You have to really be brave and go out there and make your own mark. You can't copy other people's ideas because if you analyze a lot of the films that are successful at the moment, they don't hold water, and yet they are successful and they work as a movie. It's a very interesting time. It's a very competitive time to be making good action, but it is a wonderful time to be doing it too. The rules are far less stringent than they were 10 years ago, and certainly less stringent than they were 20 years ago.
Yeah, it's also, I know that too, it's crazy over in Asia, and I've always been like a big Jackie Chan fan, and knowing a lot about him and stuff, and it's like compared to over here where it seems like the rules, they're like really different, and that's why they're kind of like really crazy over in Asia, and then it's like difference here, but
I think it's opened up here. I think that's not true anymore. I've made films in Asia, and they're not like they once were. I work with Tony Jaa's stunt team in Bangkok, and
really,
they disappointed the hell out of us. They weren't prepared to do anything dangerous. They didn't want to do any of the. They were far less
really?
Prepared to do. Oh yeah, 100%. It's the biggest disappointment of my one of the bigger disappointments. Career. I had a stunt coordinator called Garrett Warren, who's awesome and he's terrific. He's doing Avatar and all these pictures now. He ended up having to pretty much put on the wardrobe of all of our lead actors and double them. He'd fight himself in some scenes because of the 30 stunt guys that were provided to us, we could not find guys to do what we needed. Didn't have the skill level. And then we started to do research into, you know, because we're like, how on earth did they come up with a film like Ong Bak then? And you look at it, and they spent a year and a half putting that together, you know, or Chocolate, which I like an awful lot.
Chocolate,
you know,
Yes.
They trained it for 2 years. 18, you know, I mean, it was, you know, and now you just simply can't afford to do that here, you know. People cost money, even if you can get them to work for you for $300 a day, you know, on the, you know, the low budget SAG rate, then, you know, 268 or whatever it is, then you are, you know, that would be cost prohibitive to do, you know. So, you know, it was an eye-opener, it really was. I mean, and that's not to take anything away. If you've got the time and if you can spend a year and a half, 2 years preparing a film and you make a wonderful, wonderful movie like Ong Bak, then that's fantastic, that's good. But you couldn't do that here, and you have to work a different way. You know, you have to work a very different way. You have to have guys that are of a skill level that they can come premiere. I will stand by this 100%. The highest level of skill amongst stuntmen that I've encountered so far is in America. You know, it's these guys are the very, very best there are here at working at the top tier level at the moment. You know, technology wise, skill wise, ability wise, 100%. Total. You know, now there may be some great guys in England as well. I don't know. I haven't worked with them. I've only seen the ones who are working here who are very, very good. But for me, and having worked in a lot of countries, this is my personal opinion at the moment, you know. And it was a disappointment because we, you know, as I say, I loved Ong Bak, I loved Chocolate, but it's a different set of goalposts if you're going to spend a year and a half preparing it and, you know, churn through enormous amount of stunt guys because you're hurting them and sending them to hospital and causing injury, you know. Knock on wood, you know, I haven't, you know, as a director, as a coordinator, I've never had a serious injury, you know, with my stuntmen. You know, we are very, very careful, and we make it look like, you know, they're doing dangerous, awful, you know, life-threatening things where it looks like there's no way they could have walked away, and, you know, and we put ourselves, but these guys get up and do it again and, you know, go home and have dinner with their families. And, you know, you know, for me, if you're going to make a movie and you're going to send a guy to hospital, you know, in an ambulance because it's done, you know, done in such a way that he hurt himself, then that's not really a you know, tide mark of great innovation to me. You know, it's just my opinion. You know, you may make for some, you know, some interesting looking movies where you do have those, but for me, the greater challenge is to make that stunt and not actually hurt someone, not actually send them to jail, you know, to hospital, you know, not a jail.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I guess another thing too is like I'm kind of thinking of how to for safety reasons, because I've always been a little nuts like doing things my whole life, and I've actually, this people think this is crazy, but I've actually done a little fights where we had no padding or nothing. We had nothing when we hit the ground, and I'm learning
because you're wearing a swimsuit or something, you mean.
Well, it was something where I've done like I go, never again will I ever try to do working in a mini skirt with high heel boots. And
no,
I did that, and I'm
tough.
Like,
people don't realize that with, you know, stunt women, some of the toughest characters out there. Stunt guys are wearing combat gear and army outfits, and we get to hide pads all over the place. These poor gals, like, most of their career is spent doubling a woman in lingerie or swimsuit or miniskirt. It's terrible, you know. But they have those ice skater pads now. You've seen those ones that are like a very, very thin gel pad that you can stick to the sides of the knees and things like that.
Yeah,
it's certainly a harder time. You're right. There's no escaping that. You know, as a stunt woman, you're gonna do stuff, you know, for a lot of your career that is not, you know, you're not going to have the luxury of being able to hide anything. You know, it's a tough one, but that's why these gals are really, really good. You know.
Yeah, it's hard, and I says I'll never do a mini skirt. I was like, I felt so uncomfortable in my, you know what I'm saying? It's something where everything I do, I cover up from like head to toe, and it's like that's why I look for stuff. I mean, everybody's different. I look for parts where I know I can give my 100%, because they say if you never feel comfortable doing it, you know, I probably had a couple of chances to do stuff, but I was like, I don't think I would be comfortable doing it. People saying, oh, you're going to limit yourself. It says, no, because I'd be willing to jump off a building. You know what I'm saying? So I'll go jump off a building, and people are like, you're really crazy, and it's things that I like doing. And like with what you said with your own success, and everybody, my guest says, follow what's going to work for you. And this is what I'm doing, and this is what I'm finding out works for me. You know,
that's basically
what your path is, right?
Yeah, I mean, the thing you'll do is, you know, if you watch any of the successful stunt women, you know, they have their war bag, you know, their pad bag, and they have a lot of different size pads and a lot of different color ones. They've really done their research. They've looked into, you know, as I mentioned, I saw the ice skater pads, and they've worked out how other people do it, because there's no store you go to for stunt women's stunt pads that doesn't exist. So they have, you know, you have to be innovative and have a sort of a mind that grasps, you know, those kind of problems and has fun solving them. Kylie Furno, who doubled the sip on Thor, is one of the best in the world. Stunt women go and very, very smart, innovator. And you watch her open the kit bag up and say, well, I don't hit the side of my knee, and then the hip, and then the elbow, and she'll come up with the perfect pads to cover that. It's always fascinating. You know, you've got to survive. You've got to walk away from that job with your joints still working, because you may need them tomorrow. You know, you can't degrade your body, you know, for a stunt. You know, you have to work out, as I say, how to do it multiple takes with the same amount of energy and enthusiasm each time. You know, there's always a certain amount of grit, you know, where you just got to bite down on it and go for it, whether it's going to hurt you or not. But for the most part, you really got to try and look after your body and make it look like you're taking huge risks. And that's where the science comes into it. Silly. You know, that's where the cerebral part of stunts comes in, is self-preservation. And, you know, you've got to get out there and really, really work at it and do the research and train at the weekends, go to the gym, you know, go to these gyms and put together fight scenes and find out which parts of the body, when you hit the ground, you tend to hit first, whether it's your wrist and your elbow or your right knee, and sort of, you know, everyone's slightly different. Everyone has a different way of falling and hitting, and you got to be disciplined enough to know that and do it enough times so that you can cover and brace that and put a little pad there. And try and apply a science to it, and you'll find longevity is there. It'll also become more fun as well.
It's really funny, because I've actually had injuries, and they were like nothing to do with stunt set. And like I had to call out a sick out of work, right, because I actually injured myself in my house. And they're like, people are like going, well, don't you do stunts and stuff? It says, no, you don't get it. You're preparing.
Those are the most uneducated people out there, and you just have to smile at them. I've had it my whole career. You know, I've had more injuries doing, you know, as a director than I have as a stuntman. You know, you're bruised up and pumped a little bit doing stunts, but, you know, when you're focused on something else, thinking about doing something else, you walk into a pillar or you trip over a step and silly stuff like that while you're directing. And people make those idiotic comments like, oh, aren't you a stuntman? You're thinking about self-preservation when you're directing. You're thinking about how to make the day in 12 hours and not go over time, and how you're going to get that actor's performance who's just, you know, locked themselves in the trailer and is refusing to come out. And sure enough, you are not thinking about, you know, the steps that you're walking down or something like that. No, it's a fascinating thing. It is interesting. But, yeah, at the end of the day, you have to just, you know, people always have their opinion about the job. You know, I get calls, emails, weird messages all the time from people saying, yeah, no, I drive at 100 miles an hour wherever I go, and whenever it's snow here, I jump out the window into the snow. I'd make a great stunt man. I've broken every bone in my body. And it's like, the three things you mentioned qualify you as a person I'd never hire ever and avoid at a party, and certainly wouldn't want hanging around me. On fascinating, as I say, you know, what one person's perception of what it is you're looking for in a stunt man is. And it certainly isn't, you know, willingness to hurt yourself.
Yeah, you have to know. I mean, you can know your limits. I mean, I guess everybody's different because I always have, like, a lot of the Asian actors and overseas. I was able to watch so many beautiful things. And they're like, Shelley, remember that these people, because I have basic beginner martial arts skills, and I'm an actress that does a little bit of my stunts, and I say I want to do this and this and that. The reality is getting more into it, seeing it's like, what can you really do without killing yourself? And that's what you have to bring, because I was like, yeah, this is awesome. And then I realized that you guys have been doing this stuff for decades, and I won't be able to do what you guys do. I can only be capable of doing what I'm going to do, you know, like the in reality going, that's cool.
I don't know. I wouldn't necessarily sell yourself short. I think, you know, an intelligent human with commitment and a week or two, 3 weeks can if they prepare to really get down and dirty and commit. I've seen actors do this. You know, you're amazing what you can take in if you really, really want to. Times that by a few months, and then times that by a year or two. And you know, I've seen people transform themselves. Stunt guys who decided they wanted to open up into a different discipline, who wanted to take up, you know, to work on their rigging skills, you know, and then set their mind towards it, to work on their martial arts skills, set their mind towards it, work on their sword fighting skills, set their mind to it. You know, if you are disciplined and you are, you know, dedicated and knuckle down, the sky's the limit, and I would never, ever sell yourself short because you don't have a couple of decades. That's horse manure, and anyone who's telling you that is holding you down, you know. No, if you feel you want to, you know, want to work on your wushu skills, and you get with a class, or you get with a personal trainer, or you take two different trainers, and you train at two different schools in a week, you know, wushu schools, and you get down and you do it, you knuckle down, and that's a lot. You know, if I had to choose a character trait that all of the successful stunt men and women had, that, you know, that was in common, it would be the ability to train themselves in any discipline that they needed for that particular, you know, for that job. Who would get out there and say, look, no, I'm going to knuckle down, I'm going to learn it. And you see them on set oftentimes, and they just continue training. They love training. They get into it, and it's a mindset. It's like, and it's the same for card riding. You know, you go to the Rick Fingers school, or you go to the, you know, the Bodoan school, or you know these are schools where they teach fast stunt driving, and you go out there and you take the course, and you take the next course, and you take the next course, and you keep applying, you know, discipline to, you know, the process, and you get good, you get very, very good, because you are learning the science behind this stuff. And absolutely a big believer in that. It does not take as long or as much as you think. It just takes a mindset. And as I say, if there were anything, you know, from Hal Needham through to you know, the new guys that are coming up, the one thing they all have is a sense of dedication and professionalism, which is almost unique in my experience to stunt people. And it's like you choose this strange discipline, you know, driving a car on two wheels on its side, or being able to do a seven, you know, aerial martial arts that, you know, where you're doing multiple kicks in the air without touching the ground. You choose these, or parkour, you choose these things, and you actually knuckle down and treat it like a 9-to-5 job, and you get in there and you damn well work hard at it, you know. And I've seen just amazing things that people can do, you know, over a fairly short period of time, you know, because their depth and their minds are open, you know, and they're there doing it. You know, it's not a task. It's something they enjoy, you know, taking on as a challenge, you know, and you can see them. This is great. How did you do that? Let me give it a go, you know. You know, they're the most competitive bunch as well, stunt people. You go on any set, there's always someone, you know, there's some bit of competitive, you know, nonsense going on somewhere where someone's trying to do something, you know, between takes, trying to do more chin-ups, or trying to do a better kick, or trying to work out how to balance for longer. You know, and this is the mindset, I think, that survives and flourishes in that particular industry.
Yeah, did you have any favorite films that you've actually worked on that you can actually tell us about? Like, what were some of the favorite films that you worked on in the past recent years or so?
I really, really enjoyed working on Lincoln with Garrett Warren. You know, we helped put together the Battle of Jenkins Ferry on that train-up, 80 or 180 extras and reenactors, and then we had a really, really good, team of stuntmen that were picked from, across the country, literally, for their look by Spielberg and the first AD. And it was we had 2 weeks to train everyone up in how to fight with bayonet and musket, I did the research on bayonet drills from the 1800s and what the actual technique was for fighting with those, and how they were trained and how they might do it, and then bring everyone up to speed with that, obviously we actually only filmed for, I think it was 2 days, and mud up to our waist, and it was just terrific. And Spielberg is absolutely fantastic and very, very daring and very, very, very quick and efficient. And it was a beautiful, beautiful film to be a part of and a beautiful experience. I love working also with Garrett on The Master, which is Paul Thomas Anderson, who's one of the few sort of directors working at the moment that I just think is peerless and genius. And I love that experience, watching him work and just being a part of that team, that was so immersed in character and very, very much a method set, with Freddie. And, if you weren't allowed to call him Joaquin, and between takes he'd sit and look at the wall, and it was just wonderful to see how seriously you could take filmmaking. I was coming off lower budget films at the time, directing again. I'm back and forward between directing lower budget ones and begging for work as a stuntman to pay my bills, you deal with all these issues on a low-budget film, and none of them are really about the art of making the film, and it's so wonderful to visit a set where it's truly, truly about making the best possible film, and everyone there was committed to that, and it was a little bit of a wake-up call for me, because it's very easy when making low-budget films to get obsessed with shooting the schedule, basically, and you forget you're making something that's a piece of artwork. It's not mechanics. It's not an engineering conundrum. There's a lot of that to it, trying to fit, a certain amount of hours into a day and a certain amount of shots into those hours and making it work. But the truth is, it's an art form above all of those other things. And it's good once in a while to visit a set like The Master to remember that. So that was a wonderful one recently to work on. A few others.
But I know that on like lower budget films, a lot of times people are paying out of their pockets, and it's bigger budget films they can shoot, 3-6 months, whatever, straight. And with low budget films, a lot of us, we work a full time job and we can film when we can, like on the weekends. And filming the film that I've been working
the lowest budget ones I've done. I've been paying everyone. I've never asked anyone else to pay one of my movies, and I usually try and do, favorite nations where everyone's getting the same sort of, fee for the day, so I don't actually have any experience of a group of people coming together and paying for something that I've never done, and I'm not sure I'd know where to start with something like that. I like being in control. If I'm paying, I'm the one that can be in control. So any lower budget than that doesn't really appeal to me. And I've never actually done one that was shot over a weekend, so I can't talk much on that either. Although it would be, I guess it would be a very smart way to make a movie if you have no other recourse. I've always tried to run my lower budget ones no differently to how I'd run a big budget one. And if you're there to do a job. I'm not going to let you fly if you're doing a terrible job. You'll be sent home. Just the same as you were if I was paying you $1,000 a day, $100 a day. It's the brutal reality of it. And I think it's taken a few people by surprise more than once. But you're not there doing me a favor. You're there to make a movie, and to do a very good job. And whether it's $100 or $1,000, you're going to get sent home if you don't do it well. You're going to get patted on the back. And the wonderful position I'm in is, and I am able to then turn around and give a lot of these people who I've given a break to, who maybe never worked on a film before, if they've done a good job, I'm able to give them a job and a start later on in a career that has ended up buying them a house and, buying nice cars. My sister-in-law has just bought her first house. She started out designing the costumes, for $100 a day. She's now Sharon Osbourne's, stylist, and
doing TV and it literally has bought a first house. So I mean, I don't take the fact that they're being paid any less as an excuse for doing shoddier work or being able to get away with anything. So,
it's really hard, and it's like when you try to, you know, make a film with indies and stuff, and then if people don't show up and they're a lead, it's kind of stressful because everybody
right.
else shows up, and it's like you're trying to put in something.
I don't think I've ever had anyone not show up. I've had a few people turn up late, and you have
mm-hmm.
they get one discussion. You know, they get one.
Yeah.
But if I'm paying and it's coming out of my either money that I put in personally, which I've done once, or money that I've raised, in which case I feel almost more obligated because it's someone who's trusted me to entrusted
mm-hmm.
me to bring me a film, and if they're late more than once after a discussion, it simply won't work out. You know? So I don't have that problem. I've never had an actor not turn up.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Oh.
Yeah.
It's something. So
most,
it's a blessing
for the
things
that
well.
Ahead of everyone else, they're so excited to be there.
Yeah, I mean, I just had some experiences. It's okay, so you know, you figure out. I mean, I figure out who I really feel comfortable working with, and those people that I like working with again. And once I see certain things, I'm like, okay, move on, and realize I don't think I'll work with that person, or even
right.
dedicating
right.
to a film where. Like, even my hair color, this is how dedicated I am to a film, because I want to go back to red. But because
right.
my character is the same character when I'm filming every single Saturday, I'm keeping it a dark color, and after filming, I'll turn it back to red. And it's something like, even those details, I'll be dedicated. And I try to do, you know, learning as I go, and with your telling me, you know, about be aware that it is different. Because, you know, I don't know all rules on a big film set. I was like, oh, okay. And I almost feel like if I'm sitting around, I feel like I want to help. But now that you're telling me, it'll invade the livelihood because I'm used to helping out more. But now sitting here talking with her going, well, if I ever get on a big set, it'll be kind of funny for me just sitting around. You know what I'm saying? If I'm just to be an actor and I feel like I guess you have to just sit there, even though I feel like I want to help out, but I can understand what you're saying about that it's a livelihood now, I know, but I'll still have that urge like to be helpful. But I guess that's the way it
that's
goes,
a good
right?
thing. Well, you're a human being. I mean, that'll be fine, but that'll go away very quickly. I mean, you know, you're there to do a job. You know,
mm-hmm.
if I've hired a person to be an actor, the last thing I want to see him do is carrying around sandbags. You know, that.
Yeah.
You know, there's obviously an example, you know, mitigating circumstances, you know, someone's desperately trying to move something or something, and they quickly jump in. But absolutely, the last thing I want to see them do is helping around on a film set. I want them to be focused on their job. I want them to be
mm.
ready with their dialogue. I want them to know their backstory. I want them to know where their marks are, and I want them to be in character and ready to go and on time. I certainly don't want them, you know, picking up camera equipment and lugging it around. That's not why they're there, and it wouldn't impress me. It wouldn't, you know, I mean. As I say, they're mitigating, you know, circumstances where they may have to jump in and do something, but people doing their own job and doing it really, really well. Now, behind the scenes, you have these wonderful, wonderful characters called PAs, and I did that for years and years. And your job as a PA is to do everything. And that person you want. Now, if I see him sitting around not picking up sandbags, then that's a different situation. No, it's a beautifully fine-tuned machine, a good film set. And if you... You know, and being able to run a good film set, you know, being able to make sure that everyone's working, no one's coming in sitting on their ass all day long and eating a craft service and not doing anything, and the valves and cylinders all firing as they should on a film set. When it works, it's a beautiful thing. It's a really, really wonderful thing to watch. I've worked on a couple of low-budget films for people that have called me, and I looked around and said, you know, I don't really want to be here at all. It's terrible. You can see that... Now, just because it's low budget, there's no excuse that you can be unprofessional, and it's, you know, terrible
yeah.
thing. I normally find excuses and leave fairly soon, you know. They there's no point being there. You know, the picture's not going to turn out very well if there's that sort of lackadaisical attitude behind the scenes. It's not magic, you know. It's good films don't just appear. They are made by a team of people who are all focused, and it's difficult to make a good movie. I get a pretty good nose for the lower ones. But anyway, I've got to sort of round it off a little bit now, Shelley. If there's any last questions, I'm gonna sort of
this is basically how my show goes, and it's something where I like people telling the stories. You know, it's kind of a little bit interviewish, and it's like, you know, if somebody calls in, sit there and talk, you know, what the call is. And it's just a wonderful experience. And the thing that I'm thankful for, and it's like, I know you probably got so much to do today. You know what really surprised me, really, Rich? I'm always told not to judge a book by its cover. But people that have come on my show, like yourself, have become successful in their own ways. I never thought you would sit there and talk to me like a human being, because you're always thinking, oh, you know, I come from a very poor background. It says, you know, you are like the gentleman of your craft. And sitting here talking to me, it's such a blessing, and you give me such uplifting advice. And I'm like, it helps me on my path. And I'm very thankful that, you know, I just wanted to say that. Thank you so much. And is there anything you can promote, you know, before you go? I know you probably got a busy schedule. Can you talk about anything that's coming up, anything you'd like to promote, films or anything?
I'd love people to take a look at The Package, which is the Dolph Lundgren and Stone Cold Steve Austin film. That's available on Redbox. That came out a couple of months ago, and that's very, very cool. The black and white picture I did will be coming out next year. And it's called The Beautiful Ones, but I'm sure it'll have vanished into people's memory by the time it actually comes out. I directed a fan film for Wonder Woman, which is on Vimeo and YouTube through Machinima at the moment. And mine is the one that's set in World War II. Another one came out shortly after us, which is a little bit more 300-esque, but mine is the one that's set in World War II. Take a peek at that, because there will be links from the Machinima page for that one to the next one, which I have just locked pictures on, which is another DC superhero, and that will be coming out probably within the next 4 or 5 weeks. And that's a really, really cool character. He is an anti-hero, and he beat up Superman at one point in his illustrious career. I'm not allowed to say his name, but some people may know who he is. He may also be an alien who can regenerate. But it's very, very cool. It's a 5-minute short that was done, as I say, for Machinima, and that'll be out probably before anything else. So really enjoy chatting with you, Shelley. And
thank you so much.
I look forward to seeing you do great things and making waves in stunt world, and I'm sure I'll be hearing your name very, very soon.
Oh, thank you so much, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your Sunday, and I hope you'll be a guest sometime in the future. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. Always, I have great shows, as always. Do I know I have great shows? That was, Stuntman himself. And I actually have, you know, I pulled up, you know, IMDb page. You can actually check out, you know, everything he's working on. And I think he has actually, I think when you pull up his page, I think it might be Jesse V. Johnson. So when you actually pull up Jesse's IMDb page, it's Jesse, J-E-S-S-E, V, as in Victor, Johnson. So you might want to, like, check that out and see everything he's been involved with. This is great. I just am so thankful from the bottom of my heart, and, you know, just be able to do everything, you know, that I'm doing in my life, having these great guests. I'm so very, very thankful. And be on the lookout for Falkir teaser trailer. It is actually coming out. It's a film that I've been working on for over a year. I'm one of the lead Valkyries. We actually have Thor. It is a different take from director Horror Zagora DeLisa. And just remember, anybody that has a dream, you go for it, because you're as good as anybody else. Well, everybody enjoy your Sunday. I guess there's no sleep with Shelley in a little while. I'll be going to a little bit of a celebration. But anyway, thank you so much for all my listeners, all my supporters. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. And to my guests in the past, present, and even in the future, thank you for people that are wanting to come on the show. Thank you so much from the bottom of my heart. And the holidays are coming up. Are you guys ready? Oh, the holidays. Yay. Well, anyway, everyone, have a good Sunday afternoon. All righty. Bye-bye.